Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. On today's program, Wyoming has the most dangerous workplaces in the country. But a Wyoming law could be making it worse by making it hard for undocumented immigrants to get workers' compensation.
I went to two lawyers here in Jackson, and they told me that I couldn't demand money from the company, that if I did, the company would call immigration.
And we'll hear about why the University of Wyoming is concerned about proposed changes to the federal guidelines concerning campus sexual assault.
That will put another barrier between us and survivors and addressing this issue on campus.
Also, acclaimed Mexican-American writer Luis Alberto Urrea tells the story of how he came to write his latest novel.
All that and more coming your way on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. This week, the U.S. Senate passed a sweeping and historic bill that would make the Land and Water Conservation Fund permanent, a feat that many hunters and fishermen, along with environmentalists, had thought was impossible after the GOP allowed it to lapse last year. Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story.
The Land and Water Conservation Fund has been on the federal books for around 50 years. It takes some revenue from oil and gas drilling leases on federal land and invests that money back into communities while also protecting key sources of clean water, cultural heritage sites, and other natural areas. Up to $900 million is collected into the fund annually and then distributed to states like Wyoming. Senator John Barrasso joined 91 of his colleagues in supporting the act this week.
I think it's done wonderful things for Wyoming.
Still, the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, had called for Congress to allow the program to expire right after Trump was elected. And in his first 2 years in office, Trump asked Congress to slash the fund by 90%, while also calling for a new development fund for public lands to be created. Barrasso held his nose a tad while voting to support it, especially because this time the Senate passed a permanent authorization of the legislation.
I do think that with any legislation, Congress ought to reauthorize every, 25 years or some number of years. So I'd like to see that done.
Barrasso chairs the Senate Environment Committee, and he's in the GOP leadership team that allowed the Land and Water Conservation Fund, or LWCF, to lapse last year. But he says it was never truly endangered.
You know, I took a pretty close look at it, and there was adequate funds available that hadn't been spent so that there wasn't a lapse in actual funding of the projects that are being done.
A report by the Center for Western Priorities released last August found that the failure to reauthorize the program back in September left 223 projects that would protect 318,000 acres of land at risk. But the exact number of those parcels, large and small, that were actually impacted is harder to determine. Here's Richard Garrett, the External Affairs Director with Wyoming's branch of the Nature Conservancy.
I'm not sure that we understand fully. I've read some figures that suggest that we've lost maybe $2.5 million a day during the lapse.
Over the years, Wyoming has received $35 million for a variety of state projects, and the LWCF has paid for everything from community parks and pools to boat ramps and even snowmobile trails. Garrett says he's seen it in his community.
I live in Lander. A ball field was built using LWCF money. Trails are built. Golf courses have been improved. It's spread all across the state for great conservation work.
But Garrett says the money also goes into the national treasures that Wyoming has to offer.
On the federal side, we work together with a number of other organizations, including the Grand Teton National Park Foundation, to get land water conservation money approved for incorporating the Antelope Flats parcel into Grand Teton National Park.
That's the scary part to some Western conservatives, like Wyoming's lone member of the House, Congresswoman Liz Cheney. While she still hasn't completely studied the final Senate-passed bill, she views it more through the lens of what's not in it than what is in it at this point.
Well, I would like to see more reforms than we have seen, and more reforms we're able to get through. I think, you know, the idea of sort of permanent reauthorization without the significant reforms is a problem. So I would have liked to have seen more reforms make their way in.
Cheney says the top of her list is being able to use the fund to expand federal land.
Looking at the extent to which that fund has really been used in a lot of ways to for the government to purchase land, essentially, which the government doesn't need more land, I think that's been a big challenge. So I think, you know, I don't like the fact that we've seen that it's permanently reauthorized.
Cheney hasn't decided how she'll vote on the legislation when it comes to the House, but she's not happy with much of what she's heard thus far.
There are certainly some good things about it, but I think that, you know, there have got to be more restrictions on it, so it's not just a way for the federal government to acquire more land, ultimately.
Still, the Land and Water Fund's biggest supporters, which includes fishing and hunting groups, along with environmental groups, are thrilled that it sailed through the Senate. Garrett, of Wyoming's branch of the Nature Conservancy, says he hopes lawmakers in Washington can learn some lessons from how lawmakers of all stripes were able to come together and pass this permanent reauthorization of the Land and Water Fund.
It definitely will come out of the highly politicized atmosphere, but it will also, I think, suggest the effectiveness of bipartisan approach to legislation and might serve as an example for other important pieces of legislation going forward.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
In other natural resources news, Wyoming Game and Fish Director Scott Talbot has retired after 35 years in the department. He was appointed director in 2011. During his tenure, wolves were taken off the Endangered Species Act protections, and he guided the department towards adopting a new strategic plan. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska asks Talbot about his greatest achievement as director.
I would break that out into three different categories. One would be endangered species, and the recovery and delisting of wolves and state management of wolves was obviously a huge accomplishment. The recovery of the Yellowstone grizzly bear in Wyoming, if you look at what's happened with that bear population and the status of that bear population, unbelievable recovery and conservation success story. The black-footed ferret, to be able to move forward with reintroduction of black-footed ferrets also is, it's a long time, huge conservation story. You know, as far as the department goes and department credibility, when I started as director, we were one in a funding crisis and two, we were in a credibility crisis. And we worked very hard to overcome the funding crisis. We ended up cutting about $7 million out of our budget, which at the time was a pretty significant budget cut. And I asked our people to, at the time, I said, put a face on the agency. And what I meant by that is that when someone was talking about the Game and Fish Department, I wanted them to know somebody in the Game and Fish. I didn't want it to be a nameless, faceless, bureaucratic agency branch of the government. I wanted it to be the People's Game and Fish Department. And last year, when we went through the strategic planning process, and at the end of that, we had a 95% credibility rating and a 91% satisfaction rating with the public. And that's a tremendous accomplishment.
You mentioned the Yellowstone grizzly bears, and they've been delisted and listed, and just recently they were listed back again. And you mentioned that the population recovery has been a huge accomplishment, but what about that tug of war, that challenge?
I will not tell you that the Endangered Species Act is perfect. I think the intent of the act is very, very well-meaning, but when you have a species like grizzly bears that have met all the recovery criteria since 2003 and still receives federal oversight and protection in 2019, there's something wrong with the act. And whether that be that it's too open to litigation or what have you, the grizzly bears are doing fine. It's just the people fighting about how to move forward with the grizzly bears that's the problem.
And What do you think was the most challenging thing being the Wyoming Game and Fish director?
One of the most significant challenges, and something that I think remains a challenge on how to address it, is chronic wasting disease. Chronic wasting disease is becoming an issue across this nation. I believe now there's about 28 states that have chronic wasting disease, and finding a management alternative to chronic wasting disease is perhaps one of the biggest challenges that face wildlife management in Wyoming.
And besides chronic wasting disease, is there anything else that you maybe wish that you had more time to work on?
Funding, future funding. Right now, you know, we cut $7 million. We cut over 10% of our budget clear back in 2012, 13, 14. And we have recovered short term. Long term, how do you fund wildlife conservation? Right now in Wyoming, literally, with the exception of grants, it's all on the backs of sportsmen. And there's a lot of programs, sensitive species programs, aquatic invasive species. That's a program that we need to be very, very diligent. We don't have quagga or zebra mussels in Wyoming at this point, but should they show up, there will be impacts on aquatic resources in Wyoming.
So do you think that the finance model needs to change a little bit?
Clearly, it needs to change. I think the hunters and anglers in Wyoming are willing to continue to contribute and fund hunting and fishing. But I think some of these other programs that we're talking about, whether it be sensitive species, aquatic invasive species, we need to be looking at alternative sources of funding. And, you know, the Governor Mead made recommendations to continue to fund several of those programs out of general fund. The legislature took that away from the department. And I understand that there wasn't general fund dollars for that, and they moved that over to a license fee increase that hunters and anglers picked up. But that model appeared to work very well, so that all of the citizens of Wyoming can contribute to the financial management of those programs.
Great. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me.
You're very welcome.
That was Camila Kudelska speaking with retired Wyoming Game and Fish Director Scott Talbot.
Next on the show, we'll hear from Senator Eli Bebout on his top priorities. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Wyoming Senator Eli Bebout is finishing his 12th legislative session in the Senate after 14 years in the House. He was first elected as a Democrat from Fremont County in 1986. A few years later, he changed to the Republican Party and became Speaker of the House. He later became the Republican nominee for governor and was appointed to the Senate to fill the term of the late Bob Peck. Bebout recently served as Senate president, making him the only person to be both Speaker of the House and Senate president. For the second time in his career, he's serving as Senate Appropriations Chairman. He joins Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck to discuss his hardline stance on spending and what's behind his focus on education spending.
People get mad at you sometimes. They think you're a little tight on the purse strings and that sort of thing. What's the reasoning behind that?
Well, actually, I am a very fiscally conservative, and I've been that way most of my life. It's from my business perspective, but I really go back to my grandpa Sweeler, who was a good strong Democrat, fiscally conservative, and a lot of things when I was around him and worked with him, and I just was raised that way. And it's continued, and I think you need to spend money responsibly, whether it's in your home, your own checkbook, or for the state. And when I look at the state's fiscal situation and the money we spend and the revenues and the expenditures, it's a people's money, and we do the best we can to spend where we need it, but where we don't need it, to be conservative.
One of the things that probably happened when you were away and after you ran for governor and had a couple of years off was there was a lot of spending in the legislature because we had a boom. And you, I think when you came in was towards the tail end of the boom the last time, like I did. And how much has that impacted maybe your unwillingness to spend a great deal of money now when the revenue is a little bit better?
When I was Speaker, it was, I believe, 99 and 2000, it was very difficult. And we had, they called them coffee cans back then, and we had some that were set aside, but it was almost by accident. And I remember it when Mike Sullivan was governor, and 1 year we balanced a budget on a lady passing away in Jackson, and those kind of things. Then we did the cash basis versus accrual, and we did all these little tricks to take care of it. At the end of the day, we just were so dependent on the revenues for minerals and the volatility of the price. And so that taught me a lesson. And I said, you know, Lord, let's help for one more boom, and we won't be stupid how we spend the money. And so, you know, I remembered that, and we came back and we worked so hard on LISRA, and we worked so hard on building the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund. And I think in 1999, it was maybe $1 billion. And now we're at $8 billion, and thank goodness, because what's happened is that's 20 to 25% of our revenues to run the state. Yeah, that taught me a lot about being conservative and trying to be able to set aside the money for when the boom busts, and that's where we find ourselves now.
So there are people that would say the solution to that worrying about the next bust is to have more revenue come in. You've not been a big tax fan over the years. Couldn't that, though, solve the problem?
Absolutely, but not so much just to go raise taxes. I think you need to broaden the tax base, and we need to wean ourselves as best we can for the dependence upon minerals. And the only way to do that is broaden, and I am supporting a lodging tax. I did that last session. I said that I would support it as president, and it never got out of the House, but I intended on supporting it, and it is now in the Senate, and I believe it's came out of a committee, or it's close to coming out of a committee. If it gets to the floor of the Senate, I will support that. We need to look at broadening our tax base, and yet just not to raise taxes, because part of that, I still think we have a spending problem, and we need to continue to look at ways to reduce that spending. When you look at the state of Wyoming, our number of people, what we spend versus other states, but we do need to broaden our tax base.
Talking about the spending, you've gone very hard after education funding. Explain to folks why.
Well, I wouldn't say very hard. I would say responsible. And what I do is, and just being an engineer, and I look at our surrounding states, and when you look at what they spend per ADM relative to our state, and I think we spend $16,500 to $17,000, depending on a lot of different factors in the model. And the average around our state's about $11,000 for our surrounding states. And when we look at the performance, it's good. I'm not saying we're not performing well, but we're in the same grouping as all the other states. So the question is, and it's merely a question, is why do we spend so much more when we perform at the same level? And I think that's a legitimate thing to have a discussion about. The thing that I do support and I've always supported is paying our teachers well. It's never been about not paying the teachers. I just think the whole system, the amount of money that goes into it, there's a better way of doing it. But we have a block grant. I support local control. So the only thing I know to do is look at how we responsibly fund it.
So I want to ask you this, because I was here when you developed the model, as you were. How much is this that you got mad about how the model played out?
Well, I think that the model is flawed. I've always felt that way, and the way it's set up. And we rely on consultants that do what they do. And I think there's a better way of doing the model and yet get to the money to where I think it needs to go, to the teachers. You know, we have 600 ghost teachers out there, and we understand what that is. We're paying money for teachers that don't exist. You have to ask yourself as a taxpayer, is that the way to run a program? Would you do your business that way? Absolutely not. So those are just fair questions. But at the end of the day, we want the same result. We want to do the best we can for the kids K through 12, for our community colleges, and for our university.
Need to ask you about a bill that you have, and that would be to reduce some of the taxes for oil and gas development. There were people that saw that and thought, well, now, if you're cutting the budget, why do you bring a bill like that that cuts revenue?
Well, the bill does not reduce it. It provides an incentive if you want to spend more to incrementally increase your production. So we're not giving a severance tax break to any oil and gas companies. With the reduction and the problems we have with revenues, we shouldn't. That's not what the bill does. The bill says if you want to take the risk to go out there and recomplete an existing well or to bring a well back on that's been shut in incrementally will provide you some relief. So, but you take all the risk. And if you spend $1 million for recompletion and it doesn't pan out, you've lost your money. If it pans out, we're going to give you an incentive for that amount of incremental increase. I think that's a good idea. You know, when we look in the world we compete in, relative to the Permian Basin, Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, I mean, they are really rocking and rolling down there in terms of the money and the rigs and all that. Wyoming is not quite there, and people are taking their dollars from our state and spending them there.
The final 90 seconds I have, I want to ask you about the legislature itself. You know, what concerns you? What are you excited about? What's changed?
Well, what I'm excited about is the citizenry and how we have the members from the public do choose to run, but how we have input from the public. And one of the things I've always tried to do is listen and be sure and provide them that opportunity to share with us their concerns. That's the good news. The bad news, if there is anything, is it's just more and more times we get bogged down in government and as a public servant, the time involved. And I worry about down the road that people will not take the time to be public servants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do you think about the Republican Party itself? Because it's changed, and it seems like we're starting to get a few more conservative folks in here. Is that changing things at all?
I think that the Republican Party is a big tent. I mean, I go back to Ronald Reagan, and we're never going to always agree. And as a Democrat, we never always agreed either. And I haven't really changed a lot of my philosophy. It's just I think that the Democratic Party moved way away from where I was, and I really was lined up with the Republican Party. I'm really glad there. I'm proud to be a Republican. But I support that 80% rule. Let's figure on the things we can work on together, the main one being fiscally conservative, less government, you know, people's rights and all that individual responsibility, and then let the rest of it just vote your conscience.
Senator Eli Bebout, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you for how many years of service now?
It's been a while.
Both of us a while. Thank you very much.
We'll take a short break, then learn about efforts to combat sexual assault on UW's campus and about a Wyoming law that keeps most undocumented workers from getting help when they're hurt on the job. Stay tuned right here on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
You are listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. 2 years ago this February, University of Wyoming President Lori Nichols launched a sexual misconduct task force. This fall, the group released a 5-year strategic plan that calls for changes like more bystander intervention training and increased support for survivors. Those efforts have been complicated by proposed changes to federal guidelines brought forward by U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson sat down with Sean Blackburn, the UW Vice President of Student Affairs, to check in on the progress.
One of the first big steps was this campus climate survey, and students were asked about their experiences with sexual misconduct while at UW, and that included things like rates of victimization, trying to get a handle on attitudes about sexual misconduct on campus, asking students about their confidence in the reporting process. And I'm wondering, how has that data shifted your perspective on how to address sexual misconduct?
Now having campus-wide data on all those topics you just mentioned really has allowed us now to say, okay, how do we begin to move this needle? What are our campus-specific issues? So that climate survey created our 5-year strategic plan. Every element of the 5-year No More strategic plan ties back to an element of the climate survey and ties back to an element of what we would consider to be best practices and truly data-informed interventions that on other campuses have helped them move the needle.
So in the midst of these 2 years of the No More campaign, the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, has been proposing changes to the federal guidelines as they pertain to how colleges should handle sexual misconduct. And I'm wondering, has that caused any uncertainty for you and for the University of Wyoming in this process of trying to plan into the future?
So not long after she issued that guidance, we began pulling together staff on campus to study this. And in fact, the president's No More group. We have an executive steering committee. That group has been meeting on and off to pour through all of the recommended guidance and really identify, if this is implemented as is, what that would require UW to do and where we would head. There's a little bit of angst. We don't know when either updated guidance would come out, whether we'll go through another round of review, or whether or not we'll be told to implement in 30 days. If the guidance comes out and we're told to implement within 30 days, that will be stressful for, I think, every institution in this country to implement.
Going back to the campus climate survey, you know, one thing in that study that jumped out at me was that there were students who were survivors that didn't feel great about the process, and this sort of lack of trust or confidence in the university's ability to hold folks accountable. And I'm wondering, like, over the course of this 2 years, have there been things that you've seen that makes you feel like through this process, you're gaining some of that trust and confidence back from students?
We hope so. We believe so. We have really dialed in to every step of the process and what are the drivers for how a survivor would feel coming through this process. It is a hard process. This guidance, if it is implemented, might make that even more challenging. The example I would give you is requirements for live hearings. If the final guidance directs us to have to force everyone to be together in the room, that's going to be really traumatic and difficult for a lot of survivors. We're hoping the Department of Education listens to us and others who've said, give us some flexibility, video conferencing, teleconferencing, barriers. There are a lot of good reasons to have as many people in the room together, but it is really difficult for survivors. So there's a couple pieces like that that would make it even more challenging to get survivors through our process in the least traumatizing way we can.
So is there anything else about the proposed changes that are concerning for you?
I think another item we're paying a lot of attention to is the question of jurisdiction. Part of this guidance appears to narrow universities and colleges into only what occurs on their campus. You know, only about 20 to 25% of our student population at the University of Wyoming lives on campus. Nationally, most sexual assault occurs off campus. So if there is a final guidance that really directs us to not interact in off-campus sexual misconduct, that will put another barrier between us and survivors and addressing this issue on campus.
I mean, it seems like an important issue because even if the sexual misconduct were to happen off campus, those two students could end up potentially sitting in the student union together or even in the same classroom.
Correct. Sexual misconduct is one of those things that when it happens, it impacts each student's friends, their communities. They often do come back onto campus and interact in all kinds of ways, socially, academically, recreationally. So yeah, the sexual misconduct is one of those topics that comes back to campus and impacts everybody.
Sean Blackburn is the Vice President for Student Affairs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you focusing on this topic. It is a critical campus topic.
For links to the results of the University of Wyoming Sexual Misconduct Campus Climate Survey and the strategic plan, go to wyomingpublicmedia.org.
The rates of people hurt or killed on the job in Wyoming are higher than in any other state, and many of those workers are Latino. Nationally, Latinos suffer workplace accidents more than any other group. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards found out, an obscure law on Wyoming's books means undocumented workers rarely get compensation when they get hurt. And that could be making workplaces more dangerous for everyone.
A 25-year-old immigrant got a job working for a landscaping company in Jackson. One day, he was out mowing a lawn.
I had an accident. A coworker drove over my foot with a machine.
As an undocumented worker, he was immediately worried.
Because I wasn't sure they would pay, I didn't try to go to the hospital. I went to talk to the employer. He just told me, oh, well, for you, it wouldn't be in your best interest to do anything if you put in for workers' comp or something like that. The accident happened on Friday, but I didn't go into the clinic until Monday.
Since his boss said filing for workers' comp wasn't a good idea, he still needed to figure out how to pay his medical bills, and so he sought legal help.
I went to two lawyers here in Jackson, and they told me that I couldn't demand money from the company, that if I did, the company would call immigration. There isn't a lawyer that will take a case So how are we supposed to take action against them if we don't have someone to represent
us?
Many workers choose not to sue for fear of deportation, and Wyoming's laws provide no protection from that. His plan to sue went nowhere. But there is one attorney in Jackson who takes cases like this, Steve Dwyer.
For the first 6 years, I never had any of those type of cases coming up. And then just literally within about the past two calendar years, I've probably had maybe a half dozen or so.
Right now, Dwyer is working on a case for another undocumented worker who fell off a roof. His employer had been paying into workers' comp for him, but the roofer never saw those benefits, and now he's about $17,000 in debt.
His boss said that he would pay the medical bills, and then the medical bills got more than what the boss wanted to pay, so the boss cut off all contact with the person. So the employee made a workers' compensation claim, which the division denied.
Wyoming's Division of Workers' Compensation, that is, they denied the claim because under Wyoming law, undocumented workers can't be considered employees. It's the only state that explicitly excludes them by law.
That's a very strange statute. It's structured oddly. It's hard to read. It's hard to understand. And that includes how we define employee.
University of Wyoming law professor Michael Duff is writing a treatise on Wyoming's unusual workers' comp laws. Back in 2005, lawmakers tried to fix the problem by leaving it up to employers to decide if their workers were here legally. Now, if the employer believes the worker's paperwork seems legit, then okay, sure, that worker can receive workers' comp. Duff says that's not good enough to solve Wyoming's unsafe workplace problem. He says if employers aren't tending to the safety of some of their workers, that makes it less safe for all their workers. In 2015, over 11,000 immigrants worked in Wyoming, many of them in Wyoming's so-called extra hazardous industries: construction, transportation, mining.
Somebody's going to pay. Okay, so as a society, we're just trying to figure out who it is that's going to pay, because you don't get to have human beings come and work for you and get injured and then not have any cost occasioned by those injuries, right?
You know, in my experience, I think the law as written works pretty well.
That's Wyoming Workforce Services Deputy Director Jason Wolf.
I think we are, in a sense, including them, including the undocumented workers, as long as they're providing some verification to their hiring employer that they have an authorization to work.
In other words, as long as their documents convince the employer, legal or not, they're covered. It's unclear how many Latinos are hurt or killed on the job in Wyoming because the agency's reports don't show a breakdown by ethnicity. But Wolf says, in his experience, most employers aren't working the system, and such cases are pretty rare. But Wolf admits that workers' comp does function like other kinds of insurance and would be more successful if all workers were covered.
I think that that would then require some alterations within the current statute to allow people to just flagrantly hire undocumented workers and then be covered under workers' compensation. I don't disagree with the idea. I think that would substantially, you know, probably lower costs.
As for the injured landscaper in Jackson, he says he feels the current law exploits workers like him.
To me, it seems unjust, because workers' comp, or the state of Wyoming, is allowing the companies to continue operating in the same way and affecting more workers.
He says he's been out of work for 6 months because of his injuries and still isn't sure how he's going to pay off his thousands of dollars in medical bills. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
That story was produced in collaboration with the Jackson Hole News and Guide. And now the two reporters who worked on it are here to tell us a little bit about why they decided to co-produce this story. Melody Edwards is with Wyoming Public Radio, and Allie Gross is with the Jackson Hole News and Guide. Melody, how did you guys come across the issue of Wyoming's workers' comp laws in regard to undocumented workers?
Well, I had been hearing a lot about the reliance on immigrant workers in Jackson and the rise of deportations there. And also, I started talking on the phone to a lot of advocacy groups about some of those issues. And my ears just kind of perked up when I heard about the attorney, Steve Dwyer, and how he was defending undocumented workers who were getting hurt in these huge construction jobs up there, and how they weren't being able to get workers' compensation. I had done previous stories about the high rates of Latino workplace injuries and death, and it just seemed like it was really important to let people know that Wyoming was doing something kind of different than other states in regard to undocumented workers and workers' compensation.
Allie, how did you get looped in on this investigation?
So I had also heard from immigrant advocates in Jackson that accessing workers' compensation was a challenge and wanted to learn more about that. We have a pretty significant immigrant population here in Jackson. Some say it's as much of a third as a third of a of the population here. And so it's important for us to tell stories that are affecting that group. And then when my editor told me that Melody was also digging into this issue, it made sense for us to pool our resources and work together.
How did it work to collaborate on this story rather than just tackle it like any other?
Yeah, I think that having two reporters out talking to people at the same time really allowed us to collect two times as much information and end up with a really robust and thoroughly researched story. At the same time, wading through that much information can sometimes be overwhelming, like you said. So it was great to have Melody to really talk things over and, you know, sort of wade through which details were the most important.
Why do you think it's useful for newsrooms to join forces like this?
Well, I think that in the past, there was always sort of this level of competition between newsrooms, you know, like who can get the scoop the fastest and who can break the story before the other guy. But, you know, these days, a lot of news organizations, especially really rural ones, are struggling. Luckily, that isn't the case for WPR or for the News and Guide. But I think that we're in a great position to model a new approach to finding and rigorously investigating these bigger stories.
Yeah, I think that, you know, print and radio are totally different mediums, so it's cool to be able to have the opportunity to tell this story in two different ways, both with, you know, people's voices and on the page. And then at Wyoming Public Radio, Melody was able to sort of help capture the broader statewide perspective, like meeting with professors at the University of Wyoming or talking to state officials. While being in Jackson, I was able to drill down into the details of meeting with those local workers here that are involved in these workers' compensation cases.
Allie, what can people read in your story that they might not get from the radio version? And when and where can they read that?
So the print version of the story is publishing in the Wednesday's February 20th Jackson Hole News and Guide and on jhnewsandguide.com. And I'm excited that the print version is going to be able to include a bunch of charts and infographics that are going to illustrate the scope of this issue of workplace injuries in Wyoming as well as nationally. And then there's also going to be more details of these individual cases of injured workers here, some context on what the consequences of Wyoming's policies are for all workplaces from some experts, and as well as more explanation on what workers' comp really is and how the system works, because as we found out through this project, it's a lot more complicated than it seems.
That was Jackson Hole News and Guide's Allie Gross and Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards talking about their story on Wyoming's workers' compensation laws for undocumented workers. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, Campbell County school officials are looking to expand their dual language immersion program and a conversation with an acclaimed Mexican-American author. This is Open Spaces. You're enjoying Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The idea of learning two languages at a young age is growing in popularity. The benefits are wide-ranging, from being more culturally aware to eventually being more competitive in a global economy. In Wyoming, four school districts have dual language immersion programs. In Campbell County, school officials are looking to expand their program after an explosion in interest. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler takes a deep dive.
At Stock Trail Elementary School in Gillette, kids are squirming and shouting out answers to questions. It's just like any kindergarten class, but it sounds a little different than you might expect. That's because at Stock Trail, this class and another section are a part of a dual language immersion program, or DLI. That means students spend half their day only speaking Spanish and half their day speaking English.
They are learning the language in context, so we don't speak any English at all in the Spanish classroom.
That's Javier Berbel. He's the Spanish DLI teacher at Stock Trail. He's been with the program since it started in 2016. In Spanish class, they use hands-on learning, songs, and movement to help the students learn the language. But the material is the same as the English section. Jill Phillips is that teacher.
When, you know, I do something that is math-minded, they'll be counting in Spanish in my classroom. Or, you know, when they're reading, they'll pull the language, you know, knowledge that they have learned in his classroom, and sometimes they'll apply it to mine.
The program has come a long way from its first year. Carrie Shannon is the principal at Stock Trail Elementary. She says back then, officials had to recruit people to even put their names into the lottery.
But after that first year, when the family started going, hey, look at this. This is what our kids are doing, and going out in public and their kids were using their language, then all of a sudden it was no longer, let me educate like the community and say, hey, this is a program we'll be offering. Then people started coming to us.
Shannon says there are a lot of benefits to the DLI dual language program.
These kind of programs not only help those kids develop that, but when kids are learning second languages, it really creates a critical thinking and a creativity and problem solving because their brain is constantly functioning in the two languages. And so we're just really setting these kids up for success in our global economy.
School officials and teachers aren't the only ones to see benefits. Jordan and Lexi Oslin were considering the dual language program when their child was entering school. Lexi was immediately interested, but Jordan says he was a little more skeptical.
We had some friends that had some kids in the program, and I thought, well, that's weird. I'm fairly narrow-minded, I guess. So I thought, why would we do that? That's kind of strange.
But he says after those informational sessions and doing some research, he couldn't see a downside to the program. Now he's learning Spanish to be able to practice with his son.
The really fun part is when he corrects me, and it's not necessarily on words or phrases or anything, but he corrects me on pronunciation and context. So he, you know, he has that ingrained in him already at such a young age.
Jordan says they also see benefits extending beyond just learning another language.
Culturally, what it's going to do for them is huge. We're not exactly a cultural melting pot here in Northeast Wyoming, so it's nice to have, to know that they'll be exposed to different cultures.
The DLI program isn't just for kindergartners. At Stock Trail, they have DLI classes in kindergarten and first through third grade, and that will grow every year as the students do. Shannon says on this track, students have the potential to take this through junior high and beyond.
They would be able to go to junior high and get college credit through Gillette Community College through a concurrent enrollment with our high school teachers that are already certified to teach at the college.
And Shannon says they've been working with the University of Wyoming for students to get college credit through that institution. DLI has been in Campbell County since the 2016-2017 school year when it started at Stock Trail. After its initial success, another section opened at Rawhide Elementary. And now the district is adding even more sections for this coming school year. Kirby Eisenhower is the deputy superintendent for the Campbell County School District. He says their waitlist numbers would already support another dual language section, and now they're just waiting to hear from families.
We're just looking for confirmation from those parents that they would like that experience. So it's official now if the numbers support it.
If all goes to plan, there will be around 340 students in the DLI program in the upcoming school year. In Gillette, I'm Catherine Wheeler for
an acclaimed Mexican-American writer is coming to speak at the University of Wyoming. Luis Alberto Urrea has written 16 books, including the novel The Hummingbird's Daughter and the nonfiction book The Devil's Highway, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones talked with Urrea about the border and his latest novel, House of Broken Angels.
I was a barrio kid born in Tijuana.
I wouldn't say we were poor, but we weren't rich either. And I didn't have a lot of options for things, nice things, but I had a library card when I was a kid. And I really, you know, was a reading fiend for so long. And I think if you read a lot, sooner or later you decide that you'd like to try that, whatever it is they're doing. I think it's a lot like musicians, you know, that love bands or songs so much they figure out how to play them on a guitar. I think it's like that. So I just loved stories and I loved books and I, you know, I had all these imaginary playmates in all these books and I just wanted to do it. So I started writing stories and poems and things when I was a kid.
So I understand that family has influenced your writing a lot and that in your most recent novel, House of Broken Angels, that your brother influenced the main character. Can you tell me a little bit about how your family has influenced your writing?
My brother had come down with cancer. He'd always loved the fact that I was a writer. He was also a book fiend like me. And his grandchildren had decided that it would be a really wonderful thing to give him a farewell birthday party. He was about to turn 74 and he was terminal. So everyone knew he was going to die. And so they decided to give him this final birthday party on Earth. And I think he figured out really fast that if they gave him a goodbye birthday party, he could have a wake, but be alive for it. He could actually attend his own wake and hear all the things people said about how awesome he was, which I thought was pretty funny. He presided over his own farewell. And it was a really beautiful, crazy, inappropriate, funny, tragic, all at once. My wife kept telling me, you've got to write about it. And I thought, you're crazy. What is there to tell? It's just an old man dying. I had the opportunity to hang out with the writer Jim Harrison before he died. And he had always been a big hero of mine. And we were having dinner, and he said, tell me about your brother. So I told him the whole story. And when I was done, he said, sometimes God hands you a book, you better write it. And I thought, oh, wow, maybe he's right. I mean, if Harrison says so, okay, I'll think about it. What's interesting about this funeral and this whole event that I went to is that it's an American story. I didn't want it to be a super partisan book, so I tried to demonstrate to everybody how mature I've gotten, and I made the main character a Republican, because I thought, that's my first Republican in a book.
Yeah, so, I mean, how did the election of Trump and also his talk about a border wall, how did it influence House of Broken Angels and also your writing in general?
You can't have a Mexican surname, not even if you don't want to be, not be political in this atmosphere. It just happens. And I would say that the book had a slightly different tone when I was writing it, except that all around the death of my brother, there were reminders of how toxic things have gotten. Driving to the funeral and seeing signs held up that say build a wall, you know, that was kind of a shocker. I thought, build a wall? We're just burying somebody. You know, things like that. Having people in a store stop one of the women in the family who was trying to buy a birthday cake to tell her that the president was going to throw her out of the country as soon as he got elected. And I thought, this woman's been here 65 years, man. You know, she's a citizen. She votes. She pays taxes. She works. Where's she going to go?
Do you think writers should write what they know?
What does that mean for a science fiction writer? I think emotionally, I think you have to be well grounded in the humanity of the stories you're telling. But maybe you should write what you don't know.
So I understand that when you're giving a reading, you give a performance because sometimes you memorize your stories.
First, let me tell you how that started to happen. I have bad eyesight. I'm really nearsighted, and I've got bad corneas. So I had just done the audiobook 40 hours in the recording studio. And then I was reading somewhere that had really bad lighting, and I was squinting at the book, and I couldn't see it. And I was in front of all of these authors that I revered, and I was going to choke, and I couldn't bear it. And I just thought, wait a minute, I know this. I just recorded it. I wrote it. It took me 20 years to write the book I was reading from. And I just realized in this weird kind of revelation that I knew the text. And I put the book down and just launched it from memory. I haven't been back to Laramie for a while, but I have a lot of friends up there. I used to live in Boulder, you know, so I drove up to Laramie a lot. And I used to haunt your pawn shops so I could get $1.50 abandoned Depeche Mode CDs. It was great. You know, I look forward to seeing old friends and meeting some new friends.
That's author Luis Alberto Urrea speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones. You can find a longer version of that interview, including Urrea performing his work, at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. He'll give a talk at the Gateway Center in Laramie on Tuesday at 7 p.m. Thanks so much for joining us for Open Spaces. You can hear today's show again and listen to all our stories at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also sign up for the Open Spaces podcast there, and we always appreciate when you rate it and leave us your comments.
You can support the great reporting you hear on Wyoming Public Radio by making a donation. You can do that on our website, too. And if you have good ideas for future stories, let us know.
Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.